for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. One of the biggest obstacles facing the military when addressing the mental health of its personnel is the stigma soldiers associate with seeking help. The Fort Hood killings and rising suicide rate call into question just how well the armed services are doing at providing the proper resources to its members. Joining me to talk about where the military is doing well, where it needs to do better when helping soldiers with mental health issues, Dr. S. Ward Cassells, former Assistant Secretary of Defense. Yoki Driesen is military correspondent for the Wall Street Journal. And Nancy Sherman is Georgetown University philosophy professor and author of the upcoming book, The Untold War, Inside the Hearts, Minds, and Souls of Our Soldiers. Of course, we invite your calls, questions, comments, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. And you can also reach us through Facebook and Twitter. Good morning to all of you.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Yoki Driesen, give us the most recent statistics that you have regarding Army suicides.
You know, for all the debate in Washington about the wars in Iraq and the war in Afghanistan, the war against suicide is in some ways the military's third conflict, and like Iraq and Afghanistan, it is just as complicated and complex and hard to see, unfortunately, to see much progress. The Army released data this week talking about how its suicide rate for this year, the number of suicides, I should say, are 140, which are exactly the number of all of last year, which means, barring something miraculous, the number of suicides this year will be higher than last year. That's also just for the active duty soldiers. If you look at soldiers who are in non-active duty, which could be people who were, let's say, in the National Guard, came home, left the military, and then killed themselves a few weeks later, that number is also higher than last year. It's 71, which is about 15 more than in all of 2008. And this is after the Army, to its credit, has waged an enormous effort to try to, A, erase the stigma, B, recruit more therapists, and C, get these numbers down. And unfortunately, they're not going down.
What about the Marine Corps? Aren't there similar trends there?
There are. The numbers for the Army and the Marine, the numbers don't line up because the Army is so much bigger, but the rates are very similar. The Navy and the Air Force, which do fewer deployments and obviously don't do as much combat, have significantly lower numbers and lower rates.
Yoki Driesen, he's military correspondent for the Wall Street Journal. Nancy Sherman, how well do you think the military is doing on the mental health needs of the troops?
I think the military is responding locally in the sense of training more clinicians. I'm involved at USIS and training folks who are going to be deployed. We're using medics now, and certainly chaplains have always been involved, and more people before they deploy out are getting trained in cognitive behavioral therapy and stress therapy. And as you said earlier, there's a sense of an attempt overall to destigmatize mental health and the sense that it's not moral weakness, but real stress and real breakage. But I think we're still viewing it as a local military problem, more clinicians and the like. We have a public crisis. It's a public health and social problem. It's not just DOD. This is a problem with preserving the soldier who survives injuries 7-1. 30% are coming home with stress, and the families are imploding. We still believe in a military civilian divide, but the war and the soldiers are from civilian families, and they're not well-serviced at all. So it's a global public issue.
Nancy Sherman is professor of philosophy at Georgetown University. And to you, Dr. Cassells, tell us about your work as Assistant Secretary of Defense to help soldiers who have military stress problems and mental health issues.
Diane, I'm no psychiatrist or psychologist. I'm an internist and cardiologist, but one of the most important jobs I had as Assistant Secretary was dealing with these issues that you've just talked about. The PTSD and the rising incidence of suicide, which we already knew about before I left in April of 2009, just a few months ago. And as Professor Sherman has noted, we have just turned ourselves upside down looking for new approaches to these problems. These are not new problems, but they are problems that are accumulating as these wars drag on. They're not increasing exponentially, but over time we're having more and more kids and that are struggling with PTSD, and we've had a rising incidence of suicide. It now is the same as the civilian level. It used to be half of the civilian level. You know, we'd gotten it down from Vietnam era. We'd cut it in half, and now it's up to the Vietnam era and some demographics that exceeds the civilian. So the Army has been extremely concerned. In fact, it's reached the highest levels of the Army and the Defense Department. But I would have to admit, we don't have all the answers.
S. Ward Cassells. He's distinguished professor of medicine and public health at the University of Texas Health Science Center at Houston, former Assistant Secretary of Defense for Health Affairs. Do join us, 800-433-8850, and your email to drshow@wamu.org. The question becomes, what has changed? What is different? What's happening now that perhaps had not happened previously to intensify this suicide rate? Yoki.
I think it's two issues, one a military one and one a societal one. The military one is, unlike in previous wars where you might do a tour that was lengthy, you're now doing tour after tour after tour after tour. I have friends in the military who have done four and in some cases are on their fifth tours. So you're talking about since 2001 having spent, let's say if they did four tours, 4 years deployed plus other time training plus other time when they get back. So of the last 8 years, potentially only being with their families for under two of those last 6 or 7 years. And the fighting, of course, is a different kind of fighting. There are no front lines. It's a fight that attacks come out of nowhere, disappear out of nowhere. You often don't see the enemy who's killing you or your friends. A bomb goes off and your friends are dead, but you don't know who set it off and you don't have a chance to try to prevent it in any direct way. The societal one is, with respect, I would take issue with the idea that this is, you know, this military is part of, it obviously is part of the society and part of a community, but it's also a military that's more isolated than ever before from the rest of the country. Military bases are ever further away from major cities. ROTC programs are shutting down in most major urban areas. So you have troops who come home, go back to very big bases if they're active duty, and if they're National Guard, troops who come home and then disperse widely back to small towns where there may not be therapists or many therapists, and where they may not have anyone from their unit to talk to. So you have a sort of isolating factor both for the military as a whole, but also for the individual soldiers and Marines when they come home.
Dr. Cassells, what about the staffing in terms of the Army's mental health professionals? Are there now fewer than there were? Are there simply not enough professionals?
They're still not enough because we don't want to lower the standards and let in, you know, unlicensed or amateur or unstable counselors do our counseling. But we've had a energetic program to recruit and to retain and to cross-train so that people, for example, when I was in Afghanistan a year ago this time, we had group sessions, in some cases being led by nutritionists. But these were nutritionists who had experience with people and cared about counseling and had proven themselves to be leaders and people who could lead a group session. So we were quite short 2 years ago, 1 year ago less so. We're still a bit short in counselors. That's true for the country as a whole. You know, we've not fully appreciated how important face-to-face counseling is. But let me just make one more point in that. That is that as we have reduced the stigma a bit in the military, the demand has increased because people now believe when an Admiral Mike Mullen, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, or George Casey, the Army Chief of Staff, says it takes strength to ask for help. And many of our future leaders will be people who have overcome psychological stress. People now feel it's okay to come out and ask for help. And so this has increased the need for more counselors. And there's nothing like counselors. Medications aren't enough.
But, Nancy Sherman, do they come out and ask for help? Is that stigma still part of the reluctance?
Absolutely. We have a new mental health advisory team report that just came out a few days ago showing that with increased levels of deployment, there are increased real decreases in capacity to feel good and in moral strength. So the way I think about it is some of this is old. There's still a myth of the Stoic warrior out there. I wrote about that. There's still an invulnerability, invincibility, in a sense that it's weak to show psychological and moral stress. And the other thing is that it is, there's a moral dimension to this that isn't discussed. We sometimes think that resilience is practice makes perfect. But in fact, repeated exposure degrades, but it degrades psychologically as well as morally. There's terrific feelings of guilt that sometimes come in this asymmetrical warfare, that you're killing in increasingly civilian areas, young children. Maybe it's permissible collateral damage by the rules of engagement and by most standards, but the amount of personal responsibility the individual holds is enormous.
Nancy Sherman is professor of philosophy at Georgetown University. We'll take a short break in just a few moments. We'll take your calls, your email. I look forward to hearing from you. Welcome back to our discussion about mental health in the military, the rising rate of suicides. Here in the studio, Nancy Sherman, professor of philosophy at Georgetown University Law School. She is also the author of The Untold War, Inside the Hearts and Minds and Souls of Our Soldiers. Yoki Driesen is military correspondent for the Wall Street Journal. Esward Cassells is the professor of medicine and public health at the University of Texas Health Science Center at Houston. We will get to your calls in just a moment. 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. And joining us now from his home in Kansas is Marine Major Jeff Hull. He served two tours in Iraq. He's now based at Fort Riley. Major Hull, thanks for joining us.
Thank you. Can I make one correction? I'm actually in the Army, ma'am.
I'm sorry. Thank you for correcting me. Major Hull, after your second tour in Iraq, when you were back here in the States, you were diagnosed with PTSD. And I gather you had a great many things happen to you. Describe the results of that PTSD in your life.
Yes, ma'am. Actually, after I came home in late 2005, I was assigned to the Joint Readiness Training Center at Fort Polk, Louisiana. It wasn't until 2.5 years after I'd returned that I actually had full symptoms. The effects on my life was I had anger issues, a real anger buildup, and I was having a harder and harder time concealing that from my command, and I was afraid, you know, that my work performance was kind of dropping off, which caused me to be a little bit more distant from my family. I started pushing them away. I never resorted to any kind of alcohol. I just resorted to just avoidance.
And I gather you also became very depressed.
Yes, ma'am.
Who or what helped you, Major Hall?
Ma'am, I will tell you, it was leadership. It was good old-fashioned leadership. My boss, Colonel Dan Pinnell, who was my supervisor at Fort Polk, he recognized symptoms, or he at least recognized the stressors that was causing me to become sullen, withdrawn from the rest of the population. And it wasn't really a command referral. It was more of a, hey, I'm gonna see you through this, which was just flat, good old-fashioned leadership.
What about professional counseling?
Well, in the beginning, this would have been in early 2008. I actually had a hard time finding good counseling. Without Colonel Pinnell's help, I would have never found the Deployment Health Clinical Center at Fort Riley, Kansas. I went to a couple of psychiatrists, and it didn't help me. I was pretty much bent on not taking medicines, too. So I found the right psychologist at Fort Polk who referred me to the DHCC in Walter Reed, which is a three-week program. And I think that saved my life.
Major Hall, tell me how difficult it was for you to ask for help.
Well, ma'am, I've been in the Army since 1988, and I was built, bred for a culture of toughness, that you did not complain. Unless you physically could show an arm missing or a leg missing, you did not hurt. I'd actually, previous when I was a lieutenant, had a broken foot, and I, you know, stupidly now, I walked around on that thing for 2 years before I really got any treatment or help for that, mainly because the culture that I live in is one that you have to be very tough. You cannot fall out. So to seek help for mental issues, it was a monster hill to climb. I did not want to do it. I was afraid for my career.
And what about your family? Are you married? Do you have children? How did they react?
Yes, ma'am. I've been married to my high school sweetheart for 18, going on 19 years.
Congratulations.
Well, thank you, ma'am. And I have two teenage daughters, and the strain on them was enormous. Again, here was, I was a very happy type of person, but when I came back, my wife will describe, the second she saw me come back from my second tour in Iraq, I was a changed person. She could see it in my eyes. And I just didn't want to talk to her about it. I didn't want to expose my children to the pain that I was going through. So I immediately began to push them away from me, and up to the point where I actually told my wife to load the kids up and leave me.
And I gather she did not do that?
No, fortunately for me, she didn't do that.
So, at this point in your life, having been given the help that you needed, having gotten over that big hump, how would you describe yourself today?
Ma'am, I think I'm mission capable, mentally. I'm definitely probably 110% better, knowing that that there is help. I will not lie to the citizens of the United States and tell them that there's not a 800-pound gorilla that follows me into the room sometimes. But I have seen a complete change since the Real Warriors campaign started their campaign against stigma with the leadership. The leadership is now starting to get this. It has been a little slow, but they are starting to get the fact that these are wounds. They're unseen wounds. But I would say, well, I'll just give you this example. I went from captain to major during this period of time, so it did not kill my career.
So there is now this website, realwarriors.net, and you would, I gather, advise people who are suffering, as you have suffered, to go to that website.
I would absolutely. It's definitely a start. There's a lot of resources on the website that they can contact if they're looking for help. And I'll tell you, it's not an easy road. To be perfectly frank, some of the care providers that you'll run into in the system may not be a perfect match for you. This site and other sites like it can provide help searching, shopping around, if you will, for a perfect fit. But there is somebody out there that can help you.
That's a wonderful piece of thinking to offer to those out there who may need that help. Army Major Jeff Hull, thank you for your time this morning. Thank you for the service you've given to our nation.
Well, thank you for what you're doing too, ma'am.
All right. And that website, once again, realwarriors.net. Nancy Sherman, what do you think of what you've just heard?
I think that's a brave man, and I think he points to the critical role of leadership. Mental health care workers out in the field deployed in deployed in bases in Iraq and Afghanistan, whom I know are trying to sell their wares, get to know leaders early on so that the units and the leaders of those units will know that they're available and ready. And the destigmatization is critical. Post-traumatic stress disorder, called a disorder, is itself a disservice. It's not a disorder. We don't speak about limb disorder. We don't speak about paralysis disorder. It's an injury, invisible but ever so much present. And I think just one other piece to this, a lot of the soldiers that are coming home showing PTSD symptoms also have the signature injury, traumatic brain injury. We're dealing with neurological problems, aphasia, rattled brain, old shell shock, that have similar symptoms. I would ask the question, how did his family cope? Were there adequate services for them as well?
Mm-mm. Yoki Driessen, the president, is in the process of gathering information from his top professionals as to what to do next on Afghanistan, should he decide to send thousands more troops to Afghanistan, how much worse could the shortage of professional help for these people in service become?
You raise a very good question. I mean, there's an attempt to try to get more help, not just from when the soldiers and Marines come home, but sent to Afghanistan, to Iraq, so they have access to it while they're there. When I was there a few months ago, one of the bases I was at, this little out-of-the-way place in eastern Afghanistan that was getting rocketed literally every day, there was a Navy captain, which was the equivalent to an Army colonel, so fairly senior officer, who was living at the base for a few weeks, trying to, while he was there, talk to every single person at the base, which was fantastic for the guys there because they're so far from any other base that that's literally the only access they would have. But as you might imagine, there are not that many senior officers, A, who are in a position to do that, or if they're civilian in a position to do that. So right now, the Army estimates, the Army alone, not the Marines, the Army alone estimates it needs about 60 more in Afghanistan right now just for the current troop levels. Mm. If those levels expand, you know, you could see those numbers rise exponentially. One very quick point about Major Hall. I want to highlight for listeners who in listening to that may not have picked up on two things he said that are unusual. One, his insistence on not trying to take any kind of drugs. One issue in the military now is so many soldiers have antidepressants, sleep medication, et cetera, and it's not clear what linkages there may be between the use of that medication and suicide or other problems. So his insistence on not taking it is very interesting because it's not the norm. I would also just give him credit for talking about it by name publicly. It's not often that you find, even now, officers especially willing to, by name, talk about being scared, being angry, having their family see them as different people. So him being willing to do that, that's not the norm.
Dr. Casales.
Well, I'd add to what Yoki said, that it's great that the Army's letting him speak. Undoubtedly, his comments were cleared by the Army, and I think that's really a sea change, that the Army's trusts a guy who's obviously... the Army is walking the walk. They're saying it takes strength to ask for help. It's saying many of our future leaders will be people who have overcome stress. And by letting him speak on your show, they're showing they mean it.
And you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. And joining us now from her home in Downingtown, Pennsylvania, is former Army Specialist Jennifer Crane. She served in the Army from 2000 to 2003. Jennifer Crane, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Diane. Good morning.
Good morning to you. Your first day of boot camp was 9/11/01.
Yes. Yes, it was.
And you really never expected to serve. You enlisted in peacetime, isn't that correct?
Yes, it is. Absolutely. I enlisted, like you said, back in 2000. And my first day of boot camp, the towers fell, and our drill sergeants told us that we were going to be going to war, and that was it.
Actually deployed immediately to Afghanistan.
Correct.
What kind of work did you do there?
My job in the military was, I was slotted as a paralegal for JAG Corps. I also was trained as a combat lifesaver. But while I was overseas, you tend to do a lot of things outside of your realm of specialty. I worked as a liaison between a lot of the local nationals and our military members. I also provided care with some of the children. We'd go out to see the tribes outside of our base and, you know, deliver water and candy and just try to, you know, get a good rapport with the locals. That was primarily what I did while I was there.
I gather while you were in Afghanistan, you sought psychiatric help. You were eventually medevaced out of the country. What happened?
Well, about, I guess, 2 months into my deployment, I started really isolated.
Oh, dear. We've lost her. Okay, and that was a cell phone drop. We'll hope to get her back very quickly. I know she has quite a story to tell. One question comes up again and again. Do soldiers need more time at home between deployments? They're being turned around, sent right back, Dr. Casales.
Diane, yes, they do. And General Casey recognized this several years ago, that, and he's the Army Chief of Staff, that people who just had 6 months and quickly had to turn around to get some training for the next deployment, they were suddenly away from their families just after they'd gotten used to talking to them again. Because when you come home, as you know, and it certainly happened to me, the family has learned to live without you, and you have to reintegrate with the family and find a new role or resume your old role. But it's awkward, and then you need to rest. So it's a year's dwell time. That's what they call. Yeah. Back with your family is essential. And this was a tough, you know, debate in the Defense Department, because there were plenty of people who said, look, we need everybody we can to win in Iraq.
Right back.
Yes, and by winning, it's winning that will keep the stress down. Losing is a much bigger stress. Mm-hmm. Professor Sherman alluded to people sometimes feeling guilty either because something they did or they didn't do. So there was a strong contingent in the Pentagon that said, let's get everybody we can who's able-bodied and win. Others were saying, our guys need to rest. And now, fortunately, as we've grown the Army and we have more soldiers, we are able to put an end to this 15-month deployment which was very difficult. And Yoki alludes to guys that have done 3, 4, and even 5 deployments. Mm. That's winding down.
Yoki.
In the debate about Afghanistan, we're talking so much publicly about strategy. Is it counterinsurgency, counterterror? Is it 30,000, 40,000? I mean, those are the kind of headline parts of the debate. For the Army and for the Marine Corps, what Dr. Cassell's alluded to is just as important. I mean, how do you structure a troop increase such that you don't give people less than a year home? And the Joint Chiefs of Staff, by all accounts, in their meetings with President Obama and as part of the war deliberations about Afghanistan, are pushing very, very hard that no soldier or Marine should go who hasn't had at least 1 year home.
Yoki Driessen, military correspondent for The Wall Street Journal. We do have Jennifer Crane back on the line. We'll hope to talk with her after the break, as well as the recent terrible situation at Fort Hood. Stay with us.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the Annie E. Casey Foundation, working to help vulnerable kids and families succeed at aecf.org. By the Kiplinger Foundation, supporting public understanding of business and the economy. By the Gruber Family Foundation, to extend the breadth and depth of NPR's international coverage. And by the George Lucas Educational Foundation, creator of Edutopia, your source for what works in public education. Learn more at edutopia.org. This is NPR.
Julie Andrews and her daughter Emma Walton Hamilton discuss their latest literary collaboration, a collection of poetry, songs, and lullabies. The acclaimed singer and actress on poetry and music in her life, The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. And we're back, and Jennifer Crane is with us from her home in Downington, Pennsylvania. Just before the break, Jennifer, knowing that you served as an Army specialist from 2000 to 2003, you were back home out of the military, and your life began to spiral out of control. What happened?
I came home from overseas, and I knew there was something wrong with me. I didn't know what at the time, but within about 2 months of me being home, I completely isolated myself. I lived in what I like to call my own personal bubble, where it was kind of like I was watching life just pass me by. I started having severe nightmares, which I now know are night terrors. I shut down. Every part of me shut down, and I didn't want to deal with what I was feeling, and I didn't know how to reintegrate into society.
Did you seek help from the Veterans Administration?
Yes.
And what happened?
I went to a substance abuse treatment program from the VA, and I also was then diagnosed with chronic post-traumatic stress disorder, and they put me into a live-in program at the VA once I had gotten sober from the drugs I was using. And they, after about a month and a half of treatment, they told me it was hurting me more than helping me, and they let me go. And I was out on my own again trying to figure out what to do.
Do you believe that what happened to you, the night terrors, the alcohol, the drugs, were directly related to your service in Afghanistan?
Absolutely. I never had any kind of drug or alcohol problems prior to. I was extremely social, outgoing, you know, a very vibrant young kid.
And so what do you think happened to you in Afghanistan that changed you so radically?
What I saw, absolutely. It wasn't necessarily the being away from home. It wasn't the being away from the family. But it was that, you know, survivor skill that, you know, when people are dropping bombs on you, you have to basically shut down and learn how to cope with that. Because if you don't shut yourself off at that time, you can't protect yourself. You can't protect your battle buddies. And I learned how to do that on a daily basis. And when I came home, it wasn't terrifying until I came home and realized that that's not the way life is supposed to be.
Tell us about Give an Hour. That's an organization, I gather, you're involved with.
Yes, I am. Give an Hour is a national nonprofit organization that offers free mental health care to service members, veterans, and their family members. Pretty much anybody that's been affected by these current conflicts can get help through them. They're pretty amazing. I found them about a year and a half ago, and I went on their website and I looked for a provider. I said, I need help. I need somebody to, you know, please reach out and help me. And I didn't want to go back through the VA again. And I got a counselor who I was able to see once a week, and I still do, for absolutely free. And as my part of giving back to the community, since it is a free service that I do get from them, I offered to share my story with people like you and, you know, hopefully more people to come. So hopefully somebody else can get the help and not have to go through what I went through.
And just to reiterate, that website is givenhour.org. Nancy Sherman, you wanted to say something.
Just two quick points. I think we fail to appreciate that the VA not only is dealing with warriors, soldiers coming back from two wars, but has generations of warriors. My dad at 88 is still a regular visitor to the VA. Has a doctor there he sees every 6 months or so, is on meds there. And then there's the Vietnam War generation that is coming up with prostate cancer, age-related diseases, in addition to re-traumatization from watching this war, which a lot of my friends that were service members during Vietnam are going through. So the VA not only is becoming paperless, as General Shinseki has told us over and over again, it deals with soldiers of all wars at all ages.
All right. We're going to open the phones. Jennifer, can you stay with us?
Sure.
Okay. Let's go first to Jerry. He's in Norfolk, Virginia. Good morning to you, sir.
Hi. Good morning, Diane.
Morning, sir.
I just wanted to highlight one specific point that's not coming up to the attention. The Navy in recent years has been deploying more and more sailors, thousands of them, that they're not really used to in the past. The Army and the Marines are very good about developing this culture of come forward if you need help as far as depression and stuff, but I haven't really seen that translate to the Navy. And it hasn't been talked about as much, so I just wanted to bring that up, that there has been thousands of sailors deployed and injured and killed in Iraq and Afghanistan. I volunteered back in 2006 to serve in Iraq, and I was injured during the training before I got to go, and I was treated at BAMSI, Brooke Army Medical Center, where I saw a great warrior in transition program. It was just fantastic the way they were taking care of the soldiers and even the Marines, but I haven't seen any kind of program like that in the Navy.
Yogi.
Part of what he's alluding to is that while the vast bulk of the people serving are Army and Marine, he's right that there are significant numbers of Navy and Air Force personnel who are actually in Iraq and Afghanistan doing things that they were not generally trained to do. So most big bases in either country have Navy personnel who are called individual augmentees, IA is a kind of horrible military acronym, which are Navy personnel who are just sent to Iraq and Afghanistan to fill a hole, even if that's not something they had been trained to do. And he's right that when they come back, they then return to a Navy where their service is not the service that most of their colleagues would have done over that same time period.
Just on that point, those in the Navy that I know are often doing policeman sort of roles, which are particularly difficult on the streets in civilian kind of roles while they're usually seaborne folks.
Dr. Cassells, did you want to add to that?
Diane, the caller raises a good point. The Navy has had many fewer casualties, but in one group, the corpsmen, who are the medics for the Navy, they look after the Marines. So Navy corpsmen have had a lot of stress, and they are getting care typically through the Navy's Safe Harbor program. It's not as well advertised as the Army programs, but it's been successful. The Navy has kept their suicide rate down, and Nancy alluded to the traumatic brain injury program, which has been superb at the Bethesda Naval Hospital. So there are subgroups within the Navy that are at high risk, particularly the corpsmen, and they are getting care, but it's not as well known as some of the Army programs.
Jerry, thanks for your call. Let's go to Brad in Medina, Ohio. Good morning. You're on the air.
Thank you, Diane. I have to say, first of all, that I thoroughly enjoyed you in Oberlin earlier being interviewed by your son.
Thank you.
It was a real treat.
Thank you.
My son is home, actually back down at Fort Hood, Texas, after his second tour. His first tour, we noticed quite a few changes in his disposition, but he saw some pretty horrific things. He is a machine gunner on a Humvee. His second tour, he was at that soccer field holding dead kids in his arms. Many sleepless nights when he came back, and we kept on him. Are you getting help? Are you getting help? Yes, yes, yes. But we have no assurances from our point of view. It seems like he fell through the cracks. It seems like he was debriefed. But after that, he was left on his own. When he'd go back to talk to somebody, he rarely had continuity with the same person, number one. And then frequently he'd tell us that, I can't sleep, so they're giving me pills. The other side of the coin here is that we're the extended family, his mom and I, we're left out hung to dry because we're relying solely on what he's telling us. And we have no go-to person in the Army to say, and I know, he's going to be 24, but, we're victims here, too.
Oh,
and it's really tough.
Really tough, Nancy.
This is, thank you so much for that point. You were fingering something that the public doesn't recognize. They think of this as just a military problem. There are civilian families supporting their 20-year-old, 24-year-old children or fiancés or husbands and wives, and they need support. They need to be able to understand what their children are going through, what their spouses are going through, and they need help themselves.
Yoki, Brad mentioned Fort Hood. Give us an update on what's going on there.
What's happening really is the investigation is now focused pretty much solely on Major Hassan, the sole suspect for the shooting. So you're seeing it go down two different tracks. One, the Pentagon will announce this afternoon, Secretary Gates and Admiral Mullen, the head of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, will announce a Pentagon-wide probe that will look in part on Major Hassan, that's the initial focus, but then also more broadly about what can be done to better identify soldiers who may be violent, who may, if left to themselves, may eventually carry out some type of act of violence. So it will be a fairly significant, fairly broad undertaking that will be announced this afternoon. On the Hill, there's a Senate hearing beginning as well. That's looking at something a little bit different. That's looking at whether U.S. intelligence agencies in particular that had intercepted emails between Major Hassan and a radical cleric in Yemen, whether after they intercepted those, they should have done more, either to alert the Pentagon or to themselves try to get a better handle on who Major Hassan was and what he might have allegedly been planning.
So the question there is whether, and some people have said it was an act of terrorism, other people have said he was an overstressed individual who had given many indications that he was no longer fit to serve in his role as psychiatrists. Military therapists themselves are at risk of developing this so-called secondary trauma, Nancy.
This is a very big issue. How to seek help, when to seek help, where to seek help, how to do it anonymously for psychiatrists
themselves.
Psychiatrists, counselors, psychologists, very big issue, fitting it in their schedule and it not being a career breaker. So I know at Walter Reed, where I have involvement, there are alternative therapy groups, relaxation, massage, yoga, et cetera, and a support group that is going on for PTSD care workers to support themselves.
Dr. Casales.
Diane, the important thing here in general is to get on this early. So what the military has tried to do is to persuade all of our service members that it is their responsibility not only to get help early, but to look after their battle buddy. And it's the job of the family members, because if you wait until you make a mistake, until you're struggling at work, until you say something you shouldn't have said, then you have a greater problem. You may have, and then you have to dig out from a hole. So the important thing is to get help early. And nowadays you can get confidential help, face-to-face or web-based help, inside or outside the military.
And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Let's go now to Barbara in Martha's Vineyard. Good morning to you. You're on the air.
Good morning, Diane. This is Barbara Plesser in Martha's Vineyard. I used to live in your neighborhood there in WAMU in the 90s, and I called in all the time, so you may recognize my voice and my outside-the-box ideas. A few months ago, the head of National Institute of Mental Health appeared on the C-SPAN Washington Journal program one morning talking about this very issue, and I called in to suggest an idea, which I'm going to repeat now. And I'm really glad that I came at this point in the program because I got to hear what went before it. And my idea is for us to create a national program called Put Out the Fire, in which we use the whole national network of the fire departments to be centers where the returning vets can go to work with the fire departments, and also obviously the local police can get in on this too, where NIMH and the other experts in the military put together stuff on the internet that can be accessed in the fire departments where, you know, regardless where you live, there's a fire department, and so that would help with the access problem.
What do you think of that, Nancy?
It's one way of integrating military into the community, especially in these remote places where it's hard to get help. My worry would be staff it correctly and make sure that you're debriefing at the right time.
All right, Dan, we have time for a call from Cindy in Cherry Hill, New Jersey. Good morning. You're on the air.
For taking my call. I have a something I'd like to share and I'd like to see addressed. I lost my brother Ben to suicide during the Iraq war.
I'm sorry.
Thank you very much. And as a family member, myself and other family members, you know, there is a slogan that if you've lost someone to suicide, you're now a member of a new group, a new club, and one which you never wanted to join, which is rather true. And the thing I want to put out there is, after that's over and done with, unfortunately, there's this big question mark of what next. And the stigma you're talking about, you're also erased from the community and acceptance because you lost a loved one to suicide, you know, the double-edged sword. And what do you do next? And there is the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention and the American Association of Suicidology, there are branches in each of those associations that are in the United States that offer throughout the United States and also internationally.
Cindy, may I ask you a question?
Yes.
Did you have indications that your brother was suffering prior to the suicide?
No.
He None.
Was proud to serve his country, and I thought, wow, what a brave man. I could never do that.
I'm so sorry for your loss. It does seem to me that as we hear people talk, secrecy is such an important element here, and those who have served, traumatized by what they've seen, what they've engaged in, the reactions from their fellow service persons. It's really tough, Yoki.
There's also a different aspect of stigma than what we've been discussing. I mean, there is the stigma in terms of seeking help, which is, you know, what your last point alluded to. But there's another stigma that happens after someone in the military commits suicide. And it's very deeply difficult, in, specifically in the military context, even more so than the civilian one. On many bases, if you die in Iraq or Afghanistan, your name is commemorated in some way. There's a memorial. There's a tree of some sort planted in your honor. If you commit suicide, even if it's in Iraq, in Afghanistan, right after you got back from one of those countries, it's not commemorated. Military funerals are often different for those died in war and those who died in suicide, and that's also part of the stigma.
Yogi Driessen, he's military correspondent for The Wall Street Journal. Nancy Sherman, she's author of The Untold War. S. Ward Cassells, he's professor of medicine and public health at the University of Texas Health Science Center at Houston. Thank you all for your contributions this morning. And thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.